Psalm 40. The psalmist sings in praise of Yahweh, who has drawn me, he says, from the desolate pit. His need for help continues, and he admits that it is his own sins that are largely responsible for the suffering that he's having. He's come to see that what God wants for him more than anything else is that he embrace God's will in his heart. So it's pretty profound and basic psalm. And it begins, verse 1 and 2, and you can find in fact, Jeremiah chapter 30, verse 6. I can imagine Jeremiah writing this psalm. You know, the situation in Jeremiah is exactly this. We don't know who wrote the psalm. It's nothing to say it wasn't Jeremiah. It certainly fits with him. In any case, let's read what it says. Verse 1, I anxiously waited for Yahweh. He stooped down to me and heard my cry. He drew me up from the desolate pit, from the miry bog. He set my feet upon a rock and made my steps secure. Verse 3. He put a new song in my mouth, a song of praise to our God. Many will see and fear and put their trust in Yahweh, be really moved with awe before the presence of Yahweh, of our own smallness and dependence and need, but also of the wonder of God's love and mercy and all of that. That's all involved in that word fear. And they will put their trust in Yahweh. Happy are those who've placed their trust in Yahweh, who do not turn to idolatry, caught up in illusion. And we have to think of the kinds of idolatry that we're tempted towards by our culture. And there's plenty of answers to that question. Now, the psalmist passes from speaking about Yahweh to speaking to Yahweh. This forms a bridge with the rest of the psalm. From what God has done, he wants to discern God's design for him in his life. So verse 5 reads, how many wonderful things you've done, Yahweh, my God. How many things you've thought up to favor us. There's no one like you. I'm tempted to recount them, but they surpass anything I could say. The psalmist then declares his commitment to carry out God's call to witness to his personal experience of God's justice and uprightness, truth, saving action, covenant love and fidelity, and God's compassion. So he speaks first, as we'll see, of what God delights in and what the psalmist delights in. He speaks of what God has done and what the psalmist longs to do. And the Hebrew reads, sacrifice and offering you do not desire, but you have, literally in Hebrew, you have dug out my ear. So, in other words, I wasn't listening, I was dull of heart, I couldn't hear, and you just got the thing, went brrr, and dug your way in so that I would actually listen at last. You know, get it? It's a strong image and a very good one. The Greek Septuagint doesn't translate it that way. It says you have dug out, or kind of like a potter, my body. So this is why when we find it in the New Testament, you'll find body is the word used. In other words, using the word, the part for the whole. it has a, you kind of crafted my body, you molded my body, you dug it out of the clay and formed it. Do you see what's going back to the Genesis kind of image? So there's a difference between the Greek, the Hebrew and the Greek, and the Greek leads to the Latin, and the Latin leads to the ecclesiastical language right through, and therefore to the office of readings and what you hear when you go to Mass. You'll always hear the Greek version because of its tradition. So, back again, the Hebrew says, and sacrifice an offering you do not desire. You have dug out my ear. In other words, what you want me to do is listen to you and do your will, not get caught up in all the rituals without listening. Here's Isaiah chapter 50, verse 4 to 5, which I was reminded of when I read that verse. Yahweh God has given me the tongue of a teacher, that I may know how to sustain the weary with a word. Morning by morning he wakens my ear to listen as those who are taught. Yahweh God has opened my ear. I was not rebellious. I did not turn backward. If I had children or grandchildren, and since I haven't got children, I can't have grandchildren. It seems to work that way. I really think, how do I know? You know, you don't know, you just dream. But I really think I would want them to experience stacks of silence. I would want them to be silent and be okay. I'd want them to, because they've got such lovely imaginations, little children, haven't they? I'd be crying at the amount of stuff that's poured into their poor little eyes and ears today. And of course, I think I'm probably wrong, but I'm just telling you. You can't stop all that pouring in. So it's all the more necessary today in a city environment that children are given the experience of silent in great, great amounts to protect them against the onslaught of the external images that are coming in. In other words, they've got a garden in their soul. We have to nurture it. And I just think silence is so important for that. And I just thought of it here. Wake my soul to listen. And it's not just all theory. When I was a teacher in a school, and I had 10 years of it. In fact, I was a good teacher. But the kids were silent in my class, except when I invited discussion. But because I couldn't see the point of me being there teaching them something that was worth teaching, and them doing anything else but listen and be engaged. You know, they got 40 minutes. I used to say to them, well, either you're outside or you're inside. If you're inside, be inside and give it your best shot. Like, this is your big moment. Don't be in here but out there. I mean, that's pretty pointless. Go out if you need to go out. But if you're in, let's do it. And they did. I don't think it was because I just absolutely insist. I said, someone's got to be in charge. It's got to be me. So that's it. And maybe the poor next teacher after the 40 minutes of my quiet probably copped the works. I don't know what happened. But what am I saying there? I'm just saying, why don't we do what we're doing? Or not do it, do something else. But the point of doing one thing while everything else in you is not doing it, I consider a total waste of time. Do you? Am I too idealistic on that? I mean, just think, it's just silly to be doing. If you're playing tennis, play tennis. If you're washing up, wash up. Don't you think? It's not just a Buddhist thing. It's absolutely. So, anyhow, I'm getting distracted. This is all the stuff we do. And this is why this is such a profound psalm. Listening, listening, listening is the thing. And listening at the deepest part of our soul to where God is actually nurturing us. That art is. I was spoiled, given it myself in my family, but also in the school I went to, and then in the novitiate. I went into the novitiate at 16 and a half. Now, many people have regretted that since, because I was so blooming immature by the time I was ordained, and I didn't wreak complete havoc, I hope. But, you know, you can be, you just have to be who you are. But one thing I did learn, and my contemporaries did learn, from 16 and a half till 17 and a half in my life, I was absolutely silent for a year. And I would wish everyone could have it, because it's lasted me all my life. We talked after the tea for 20 minutes a day. That was it. The rest of the time was silence. And it's hard for a while, isn't it? But once you know you can be alone and be silent and it's okay, you've been given a freedom. You know it. You've been given such a freedom because you don't need noise to occupy you. You don't actually, you've got your whole life actually within your own frame of your own psyche. And that, I don't mean that selfishly, I just mean, you do know what I mean, don't you? You found something, so you're not desperate, and love is all beautiful. Anyhow, so I just wish I could find ways of helping young people, and I do my best, to be silent and listen to their own heart. Let God dig through their ears and zip their tongue till they've got something to say. Oh, you're all laughing at me as though I'm too idealistic. All right. Verse 6b. You have not asked for burnt offerings or sin offerings. Now, that's a big thing to say in the psalm because everyone's telling them that they were asked to do that. The book of Leviticus is full of it. The book of Numbers is half full of it. I'm sure the priests were always telling them, do this, and they were lining up and sacrificing. You know, the whole system was pretty dependent on it. And sheep and goats and doves and all this is going on. The rigmarole of external religious practice was rampant right through the culture. But this says, God, you didn't ask for all this. You didn't ask for it. We'll come to what he asked for in a moment. It's not meant to be absolute, you didn't ask for that. It's just say it's a comparative, say it's a Semite way of saying, put the two up and look at this one. It's not excluding that. It's not saying there's absolutely no place for that. But there's no place for that unless you do this. This is the key, somewhere else, not there. Here's Hosea chapter 6, quoted by Jesus twice in the Gospel of Matthew, in chapter 9 and chapter 12. I desire steadfast love, not sacrifice. I desire the knowledge of God rather than burnt offerings. So, okay, sacrifice is fine, burnt offerings are fine, as long as they come out of steadfast love and the knowledge of God. Otherwise, they're just clutter. And that's what Jesus had to say to the Sadducees and the Pharisees and the scribes who were all picking on him because he wasn't, you know, they were eating wheat on the Sabbath day and they were going for walks through the fields and you know the story and then all that. Here's first book of Samuel, chapter 15, verse 22. Samuel said, has Yahweh as great delight in burnt sacrifices and offerings as in obeying the voice of Yahweh? Surely to obey is better than sacrifice, and to heed is better than the fat of rams. We don't need convincing of that, but it just keeps reappearing in the prophets. But the system seems to go on, you know. Systems are very hard to do much about, and so the prophetic word gets a bit lost, but it's nice to see it all there. Now I come to the key point. Or the psalm does. I'll do verse 6 again. Sacrifice and offering you do not desire. You have dug out my ear. You've not asked for burnt offerings or sin offerings. Now here's the beautiful part. And so I say, here I am. In the scroll of the book it is written of me, I am to carry out your will. Oh my God, I long to do it. Your law is within, in the depths of my being. That might be the nicest verse we've had in all our reading of the Psalms. It's so fundamental, isn't it? And it's very beautiful. And in the book of Hebrews, chapter 10, verse 7, that is applied to the incarnation of Jesus. When Jesus came into the womb, can't say Jesus came into the womb really, but you know, when the Word was made flesh might be John's way of putting it. When, in other words, the beginnings of the life of Jesus of Nazareth, who is the expression of God's Word for the world, at the very beginning, right from the beginning, it was clear what his mission was, and that's quoted in the scroll of the book. It says, "Here I am. It is written of me, I've come to do your will." And the text goes on, "I long to do it. Your law is within, in the depths of my being." And so Jesus wanted us to listen to God and to love and obey the commandments, of course, if they're sensible, and mostly they are, obey them from within, because they're ours. They've come from our heart. And it goes on in verse 9, "I proclaim good news of justice to the great congregation." And two words, important Greek translations of the Jewish, "I proclaim good news" is evangelio, evangelizo, angelizo, gospel. The good news. Angel, angel, is to announce, to proclaim, to herald, and au in French means good. So the verb is the same word used in the New Testament for the good news, proclaiming the good news. And here it is in the Greek Old Testament already, and the great congregation is the church, the ecclesia. So it's the good news proclaimed of justice. "See," says the psalmist, "I have not restrained my lips. You know this, Yahweh. I have not kept your justice hidden within my heart. I have spoken of your faithfulness and your saving help. I have not concealed your kindness or your faithfulness from the great congregation." Great congregation, verse 9, is translated into the Greek ekklesia. The great congregation in verse 10 is translated synagoge. Synagogue, church. Same two ways of talking about the kahal, the great congregation. Sorry if I keep reminding you too often, but the word justice is very important in the Bible, and we've got to be careful of it. Justice means acting according to who you really are. That's an accurate definition. So God's justice means God always acts as God is. Now, it'll depend on how you see God to be, how you will understand God's justice. In the New Testament, once we see that God is love, God's justice cannot be balanced with love. Some people do. They say, "Oh, you love you. Oh, I talk about love, but God is also just." Do you get it? No. God's justice means that God will never act other than loving. That's what justice means. It's not an extra thing. Now, God acting lovingly does not mean that's from God. So God's action will always be loving. God's grace will always be there for all of us, all the time, forever. So that's unchanging. When it comes to God making judgments about us, of course they'll have to be truthful. God doesn't pretend. So if I was hungry and you never gave me to eat, I was thirsty, you never gave me to drink, I was in prison, you never visited me, well then, you never did. And God won't say, "Well, I'll pretend you did, and because Jesus died on the cross, I'll now look on you lovingly." No, God just says, "Well, look, I don't know you." God declares who we are. Now, that's not God behaving badly. It's God just, that's with regard to us. God's justice will always be a correct judgment of who we really are. We will be judged according to our deeds, according to our... So, "I have not kept your justice hidden within my heart. I have spoken of your faithfulness. I have not concealed your kindness and your faithfulness from the great congregation." That's verse 10 of our psalm. Here's a quote from Isaiah 40 and Isaiah 52 that I think say much the same thing. Get you up to a high mountain, O Zion, herald, angel, herald of good things. Lift up your voice with strength, O Jerusalem, herald of good tidings. Evangelizo, same word. Lift it up, do not fear. Say to the cities of Judah, here is your God. And later, how beautiful upon the mountains are the feet of the messenger who announces peace, who brings good news, gospel, who announces salvation, who says to Zion, your God reigns. And the psalmist, knowing that the mission given to him by God involves risk, prays for God's protection and help. Verse 11 to 12, Yahweh, do not withhold your tender compassion from me. Let your kindness and your faithfulness keep me safe always. For evils have encompassed me without number. My guilty deeds have overtaken me till I cannot see. They are more than the hairs of my head, and my heart fails me. We now conclude the psalm by reading it pretty well straight through. From Psalm 40, verse 13 to 17, has an extra bit of interest. It's a bit of a side issue, but the extra interest is that this is exactly Psalm 70. It happens about twice, I think, only throughout the Psalms. If I were to read to you Psalm 40, verse 13 to 17, and you were to be reading in your Bible Psalm 70, apart from the slight variations, one of them has God instead of Yahweh. I won't go into them now, but they're very slight little differences. So what probably has happened is that our psalm, maybe, is a combination of two psalms, and they got together in the hymn book. Or when the two psalms came from the Northern Kingdom, they got together and they made them one and put them into the choir book of the Second Temple, which is our psalm book, in about the 400 or something, and they've combined them. Or, alternatively, someone took half the psalm, 40, and made it a separate little psalm. But it's just a curious point. Let me just read it for you now. Psalm 40, verse 13. Yahweh, please free me. Yahweh, make haste to help me. Let all those who seek my life be put to shame and confusion. Let those who desire to harm me be repulsed and brought to dishonor. Let those who say to me, ha ha, be turned back in shame. May all who seek you rejoice and be glad in you. May those who love your saving presence say continually, great is Yahweh. As for me, I am poor and needy, but the Lord thinks of me. You are my help and my deliverer. O my God, do not delay.